Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer and reviewer James Kaplan, and we're talking about his new book, Three Shades of Blue, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Bill Evans, and the Lost Empire of Cool. James, welcome to the show. It is such a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here with you, Mark.
I don't use this word often in talking about books, but this is a monumental book, and it's got a fascinating flow because it's like the first sort of three quarters of the book builds up to an album.
Yes.
And then after that, in one long chapter, which is sort of like the denouement, the chapter's called After. It's what happened afterwards. And the album is still the best-selling album of all times. Talk about it.
Well, Kind of Blue is just an amazing album, and it's beloved by so many people. The best-selling jazz album of all time, for sure, and arguably the best-loved jazz album of all time. And it's a strange piece of work because Miles never did anything like it before or after. It sort of sits outside of time. Despite the fact that it was recorded in March and April of 1959, you listen to that album, it doesn't sound like the past. It doesn't sound like 1959. It's not futuristic music. It is just sublimely quiet and majestic and self-possessed and puts you in a different place, a very peaceful place when you listen to it.
I went and re-listened to the album just before we did this interview, and you're absolutely right. It's outside of time. If I was to not know the history, I don't know if I could date the album.
It holds up like crazy. There's nothing even slightly dated feeling about it. And Miles had great ambitions for this album going into it. And afterwards, with his characteristic artistic restlessness, just felt that he really hadn't succeeded in Kind of Blue, despite the fact that we all disagree with him.
Now, the fascinating thing about this is, and you quote Nicholas Payton, who wrote an article in 2011, who's a trumpeter, who wrote this, it's essentially like a poem on why jazz isn't cool anymore. And he writes that jazz died in 1959. It was the coolest year in jazz. Jazz worries way too much about itself to be cool. Jazz is haunted by its own hungry ghosts. Let it die. And when I came to that part of the book, I was actually shocked. But you make a case for the fact that this embodiment of jazz, that this is it. It's not going to be the same afterwards.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't the same afterwards. But so many things happened in America afterwards, and so many things happened to jazz. Not least of which was the evening of February 9th, 1964, in the Ed Sullivan Show with these four young guys from Liverpool. And this was in the deep shadow. I remember it well. I was pre-adolescent at that point. And it was in the deep shadow of the Kennedy assassination. I mean, this nation was sunk in mourning. And suddenly here, just 2.5 months later, here is this blast of light and joy that transforms the world, really. And not only transforms the world, but transforms the hopes and dreams of millions of adolescent boys who had been struggling to learn the trumpet and saxophone so they could try and play jazz. The hell with that. The next day, February 10th, 1964, they all went out and bought electric guitars. three chords are a lot easier than the fingering on a tenor saxophone.
Now, there's a very personal thing for you about writing about Miles Davis, because you actually got to talk to Miles. You got to interview him. And it was your first interview for the, what were you doing it for?
It was very early in my magazine writing career.
Oh my God.
My late brother, Peter W. Kaplan, who's a great newspaper editor and editor of the New York Observer, back in those days was a magazine editor and had an acquaintance who was an editor at Vanity Fair, which was just cranking up into the gigantic institution that Vanity Fair would be in the 80s and 90s under the leadership of Tina Brown. Vanity Fair was about to publish an excerpt from Miles Davis's memoir, which was about to be published. And so they wanted an interview with Miles to go along with the excerpt. And my brother was talking to this editor at Vanity Fair, who told my brother they were looking for a writer who knew jazz. And my dear late brother told the Vanity Fair editor that I knew everything there was to know about jazz. This was a lie of such proportions I can't begin to describe it. But at that point, I liked jazz a lot. I had a few albums, including Kind of Blue. The truth is actually, sorry, that's an error. I didn't yet own my Kind of Blue.
Oh, my God.
But somehow I snagged this assignment to go interview Miles.
Now, you must have had some trepidation because Miles by then had a reputation. He was a difficult person.
He was the Prince of Darkness. that's what he called himself. That's what everybody called him. He was the guy who turned his back to audiences, who had this fierce scowl, these terrifying dark eyes that would just penetrate into your soul.
And the raspy voice.
Yeah, the raspy voice that everybody loves to imitate. So, yes, of course, my knees were knocking when I rode the elevator up to the 14th floor of the Essex House on Central Park South in New York. That's where Miles was living at that point, residential hotel. And the door opens to his suite, and there is this tiny creature, maybe 5 foot six, standing there wearing a black silk pajama pants and little Alibaba slippers with the toes curled up, no shirt, and a giant brown curly wig for some reason that he kept spritzing with a mister. And to my astonishment, even though and Miles' publicist, who was by my side and very sort of militant presence, had told me I had exactly 1 hour with Miles. Anyway, the whole thing scared the you-know-what out of me. Mm. But to my astonishment, he was kind to me. He was kind. He was welcoming. Once the hour was up, I timidly asked if I might speak to him again, and he said, "Come back."
Yeah.
So I went back. I went back the next day, and the day after that, I got 3 hours of interview with Miles. And despite the fact that I knew nothing about jazz and had very, very unintelligent questions, it turned into kind of a wonderful interview, and one that, as I began to do this book years and years later, decades later, I had this interview in my pocket with Miles Davis.
This is an amazing book about Miles becoming Miles. And it's a long and fascinating path. I'm just going to skip around and talk about a couple little things. People may not realize he went to Juilliard for 1 year. His father, a dentist, he seemed to be a touchstone throughout the early parts of Miles's career.
Well, Miles was a rich boy. He was a Midwestern prince. Insofar as a young black man could be a prince in the Midwest of the United States in the 1940s, Miles was a prince. He rode horses as a boy. His father was a well-established dentist in St. Louis, and there was money. Miles was a precocious trumpet player who was so good at what he did that he actually got a chance to sit in with the great Billy Eckstine's band when it stopped by St. Louis in 1944. And two of the members of that band were Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker. And they told they told Miles to look them up if he ever got to New York. Well, you know, that may have been probably with just party talk, but Miles was very determined to not only look up, but to meet and to play again with Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. And so he managed to convince his father, Miles did, that he was interested in going to Juilliard. So he goes east to New York City in 1944 and enrolls at Juilliard, very quickly realizes that Juilliard is not the place for him, but in very short order meets again with Dizzy Gillespie and then Charlie Parker, who, talking about astonishments, hires him. Hires this 18-year-old to join his band.
He was only in Juilliard for a year, but I have to say, especially when you get to the pieces that are on Kind Blue, that formal academic training did him well. He was able to reference, for instance, classical composers and their ideas when he was doing pieces.
Yeah, he was scornful about Juilliard in his memoir, but of course he got a lot out of his 1 year there. And also, we shouldn't forget that Miles was an extremely ambitious and diligent autodidact, a self-educator.
Yeah, yeah.
He was always listening to the great European moderns, to Stravinsky and Shostakovich and Scriabin. And he could read music, Miles could, unlike many, many jazz musicians. Miles could read music. He would go to libraries to listen to these moderns. He would look at their scores. He took them in, and that didn't stop when he left Juilliard.
Let's talk about Miles' relationship with other musicians. One of the things this book does is it really traces Miles' long and very tortured relationship with Charlie Parker, with Bird. That was a tempestuous relationship. It just sounded not great, but he couldn't help it. But Parker treated Miles like crap at times. He sold his stuff.
Bird treated everybody like crap most of the time because Bird was a heroin of monumental proportions, and heroin ruled his life, and it spoiled so many relationships with women, with friends, with fellow musicians. When heroin is in charge of your life, it makes you do all kinds of awful things, including constantly having to be looking for money to pay for your next fix. And so Charlie Parker was a thief, among many other things. He would steal, he would borrow, in quotation marks, from other musicians, whether it was money or instruments or clothing, and he would pawn them just to get the money to buy more heroin. Bird was gargantuan in his tastes for food, for sex, and he was not easy to be around for anybody, including Miles Davis.
But by the way, the use of heroin in jazz is one of the several subtexts of this book. One of the things you write is that, you know, other musicians would look at Bird and go, well, Bird does heroin, but Bird plays like a god on heroin. Therefore, heroin must make you play like a god.
Yes, it's terrible, awful, completely false syllogism that you just mentioned turned into this great myth in jazz, and it seduced and then killed so many young musicians.
You have lists of them throughout the book.
Yeah, so many names, so many terrible deaths, so many lives destroyed, and so few survivors. One of those, however, and extremely fortunately for us, was the great, the legendary, the iconic Sonny Rollins, who I managed also to interview for this book.
Now, let's talk about his relationship, Miles and Dizzy Gillespie. How did Miles look at, as a young musician, how did he look at Dizzy Gillespie? It seemed like Dizzy Gillespie was off on another, like, planet and playing very fast, and Miles just couldn't keep up.
Yeah. Miles idolized Dizzy. Miles wanted to play like Dizzy. But Miles very quickly realized that only Dizzy Gillespie could play like Dizzy Gillespie, that high and that fast.
Yeah.
And so we shouldn't think that Miles couldn't play fast. He could, but he just couldn't be the second coming of Dizzy Gillespie. And so Miles had to turn himself into Miles Davis. But this is true of every young artist. You know, young artists have to find their models, their influences, and then they have to kill them. They have to emerge as themselves and not their model.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer and reviewer James Kaplan, and we're talking about his monumental new book, Three Shades of Blue, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Bill Evans, and the Lost Empire of Cool. There's a funny bit in your book about Miles being tragically uncool in the way he dressed, and that Dexter Gordon really gave him shit for it and really made him try to up his wardrobe.
Dexter Gordon, of course, a great, great musician himself, a great, great saxophonist from the West Coast, about 7 or 8 years older than Miles, well established on the New York scene when Miles came to town. And let's also not forget that Dexter Gordon stood 6'6", almost a foot taller than Miles Davis. And Miles comes out of the Midwest wearing his beautiful Brooks Brothers suits, which he thought were the essence of cool. And Dexter Gordon very quickly disabuses Miles of this idea. You can't wear Brooks Brothers and be cool. And poor Miles sort of, he was intimidated by Dexter and made it his business to go to Times Square and buy big shoulder, big lapel suits just like Dexter Gordon was wearing.
Now, this is an interesting, and this is another theme in your book, is what's happening in music from the late 40s into the 50s. Bebop becomes huge, and the art of the improvisation rules. But Miles ends up changing that.
Well, he ends up changing it and then not changing it. Miles changes, he makes changes, and changes happen to Miles as well. So bebop is this, I compare it to cubism, which arose in visual art through Picasso and Georges Braque in Paris in the very early 1900s. It was a form of visual art that nobody understood at first and everybody made fun of and regretted. And bebop was very similar. It was created by a number of young black musicians in the early 1940s, but most conspicuously by Dizzy and by Bird. And Miles loved bebop, but Miles also very quickly made friends with, when he came to New York, a Canadian musician arranger named Gil Evans. Mm. Not Bill Evans, Gil right. Evans, right. Not related to Bill Evans. Gil Evans was Canadian. He was white. And he was the most unracist white man that Miles Davis had ever met. Miles had huge, instant affection for Gil Evans, who was a charming and brilliant man, and very quickly began to work with him. Gil Evans had all kinds of ideas for larger jazz groups, for specifically the Nonette, the nine-piece jazz orchestra. And he and Miles worked together in the late 1940s to create these albums that were known as The Birth of the Cool.
That's right. That's right. It was on the Capitol label.
And so this was a new kind of jazz that branched off into a new variant of jazz called cool jazz. But it was not Miles' only interest in the time. Miles had a great parallel interest in improvisation. And so both these streams of jazz occurred simultaneously.
It was fascinating because you're right. In 1959, Miles got to see the National Dance Company of Guinea, Le Ballet Africain, on Broadway, and he was bowled over. He was so impressed by the marimba and all sorts of other things, and he wanted to incorporate some of that sensibility into the album.
Yes. So Miles was very like Picasso in a lot of ways. He had this intense artistic restlessness. He never could stay in the same artistic spot for very long at all. And by the late 1950s, and this is there's a lot of history that happens in the meantime, primarily in 1955, Miles plays at the Newport Jazz Festival, which is attended by George Avakian, who is head of jazz for Columbia Records, which is the biggest record label in the United States. And Avakian has this vision of hiring Miles, this vision of Miles Davis as a great ballad player. George Avakian had no interest in bebop. He felt that it wouldn't sell to the masses. He felt he could sell Miles to the masses. So, and Miles was all about selling records. Miles was delighted to sign with Columbia Records. Miles also wanted to keep playing fast. He wanted to have his cake and to eat it too. So late 1950s, Miles begins to get impatient with the state of jazz as it is then, which is a lot of which is based on American songbook standards and also on jazz original songs that have a lot of chords. And Miles, as you say, he has this Satori, this moment of realization when he goes to see this the Ballet Africain. It's not only the dancing and the drumming, but it's the kalimba, African finger piano. And Miles wanted to create a new kind of jazz with many fewer chords and with different modes, that is, different scales in it, different sounds. And these were the twin ideas that he began to form the concept of Kind of Blue upon.
You write that he wanted to keep it simple, and he was also important. He really would love if the first take was the one that they used.
Yes, and this was, and again, this was a very different ideal for jazz from cool jazz and from written charts. Yeah, spontaneity and simplicity. And then he heard this miraculous piano player down at the Village Vanguard, this young guy from New Jersey, young white guy with glasses who looks like he could teach high school biology or something. And Bill Evans is listening to the same things that Miles is listening to. He's listening to Ravel. He's listening to Stravinsky. And Bill Evans is somehow managing to get these sounds into his piano playing, and Miles wants to get Bill Evans and those sounds into Kind of Blue, along with the simplicity, the fewer chords.
As a matter of fact, he planned the album around the piano playing of Bill.
He planned the album around the piano playing of Evans. He also wanted to get in a sound he had heard as a boy visiting his grandparents' farm in Arkansas, walking back home late at night along a dark country road and hearing the ghostly sound of black gospel singers coming from a nearby church. So he wants to get that sound and the African sound, the kalimba, the finger piano, and Ravel and Stravinsky. It's a lot to pack into one album, but paring away all the levels, Miles gets this brand new sound that really only happens once on this album, Kind of Blue.
We've got 1 minute left.
Oh, no.
I know, I have pages more questions. But I just want to ask you this, because this has struck me as also sort of funny. So what, the signature number from Kind of Blue, the title came from Dennis Hopper?
Well, that's what Dennis Hopper said.
Okay, all right.
It's not implausible. He used to spar with Miles. Miles was a boxer, and they would get into the ring together, and there would be trash talk. And Hopper's trash talk was, come on, Miles. You ain't got anything better than that. So what, Miles? So what?
Was there another plausible theory about where the title came from?
Yeah, this was one thing that Miles's relatives used to say when Miles, who put on all his airs, left St. Louis and went to New York. They would say, "So what, Miles? So what?" So Miles was getting him back with his greatest jazz song of all time.
I mean, that composition, that piece is so amazing that as soon as you say the words, at least to me, in my head, the Bill Evans piano work at the beginning of it is plays in my head.
Yes, and Paul Chambers' miraculous bass playing. It is, yes. And Miles' solo on that song, a great jazz song in itself. It's just, words fail me, Mark.
Now, we neglected to talk a lot about Coltrane because that would be another whole show. But just to give you a sample of James' writing, Coltrane seemed to quote only from God. That was fit. And that sort of sums Coltrane up.
Yeah, well, yeah. You listen to great Charlie Parker and the great Dexter Gordon, and they throw in all these cute little quotations from popular songs and spirituals, what have you. And there's Coltrane, exactly, quoting only from God.
Yeah, he's in a different zone.
Yes.
Yeah, he transcends a lot of other things.
Miles saw it.
I know. It's amazing. Again, we've only been barely following one thread of this book, of which there are many threads, and it is an amazing book. My guest tonight is writer and reviewer James Kaplan, and we're talking about his new book, Three Shades of Blue, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Bill Evans, and the Lost Empire of Cool. James, it's been a pleasure.
Mark, always a great pleasure talking to you. I hope we can talk again.
Oh, I hope you do. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.